Hello and welcome to What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest about horror films. And we talk about a particular topic that I've previously randomly chosen. And we pick two films that have to do with those topics and discuss them. So this week is all about cop procedurals, which are also called psychological thrillers, I guess. And many have kind of debated whether it is part of the horror genre. I think it is, and it's my podcast, so that's what goes. So this week my special guest is returning guest Mal Jutley. He was here before talking about Urban Legends, where we talked about Candyman and I Know What You Did Last Summer. But this time we are discussing two massive hitters, I guess, in the cop procedural psychological thriller genre. It is 1991's The Silence of the Lambs and 1995's Seven. So enjoy my chat with Mal about these two cop procedural films. So I would like to welcome back to the podcast, last time he was on here talking about Urban Legends, and now he's back. Mal Jutley, how are you?
Hello. Yeah, good to be back, I suppose. It's been a while, but yeah, thanks for inviting me back on.
No bother. What have you been up to since we last talked? Well, since we last talked on the podcast, we have talked since then.
Yes. So much. It's just like we were saying in the preamble before, it's adulting, really. Just work and family and, you know, trying to do whatever you can do just to make sure the days get, you get through the days, and then where possible, you just throw in a bit of time for yourself. And then I've been doing, like, obviously, you know, I'll be at festivals or movie events, so I do plenty of that. And yeah, just trying to keep busy. And then I don't like a quiet week, as you probably recognize from my social posts. I'm always doing something somewhere to keep me on my toes. But yeah, busy is the way for me.
That's good. So this time we are talking about quite an interesting subject. It's one of those ones that's quite divisive, because some people believe that this type of movie isn't horror. Some people feel like this is more thriller. I feel it kind of straddles the line. We are talking about procedurals, cop procedurals. They get called psychological thrillers a lot. What is your opinion? Do you think they're horror?
Well, the film we're about to discuss definitely falls in that category, but they can. So the whole point with these sort of films is very much about, it's a slow, methodical narrative in the films, most often than not. That's why it gets that psychological thriller thing. But a lot of it is around, you know, piecemeal stuff. It's like the whole trend of serial killer podcasts, serial killer TV. It's all about mapping things together, putting clues together, gathering evidence, you know, interrogate, that sort of stuff. So it's all about the nitty gritty that really makes us want to get under the fingernails of what we see. So I think it definitely does fall under that category, because as we've discussed many times before, horror is subjective. So what you see on screen and what you interpret can be horrific for whoever is understanding it. And even if it's a cop procedural, that in itself, what they're discovering, what they're investigating, what they uncover, can be quite horrific. Yeah,
it's definitely kind of the horrors of humanity and, you know, human psychology a lot of the time. You know, our brains are just like the ocean. A lot of it is undiscovered stuff that we'll probably never understand. And of course, that lends itself to darkness and horror, like we'll see in the films we are discussing. Are you a fan of cop procedurals?
I am. So all, and again, all types of, first of all, I love a cop film anyway. So anything they've got, you know, a cop type of film, Training Day, Lethal Weapon, those sort of films, I love seeing them, because I like that, you know, the either good cop, bad cop, whatever. But also the procedurals work for me, because again, I like that methodical approach to films. So for me, yes, I'm happy if I've, that type of film always works for me, because you almost want to sort of see, well, what can you do different this time around? How are you going to engage me? And that's always an impact, right?
Yeah, I really like them. I'm not so much a fan of like buddy cop films.
Or like thrillers, straight out thrillers, but I do like procedurals because, like I said, they tend to be a lot darker, a lot more. I guess it's the lens we're looking at as well. You know, they concentrate a lot on the lens of the villain and their victims, which I think lends to its horror. And yeah, I mean, the BBC are another outlet that do really good cop procedurals. Like British cop procedurals are really dark as well. And I really enjoy them.
What was that show, that one that everyone watching, I didn't watch it, on BBC One? I think there was something recently, everyone watching BBC One. It's like a weekly show. I forget now. I should have done my research on this. But yeah, you're right. There are a lot of that. Was it The Missing a few years ago? Was it The Missing? Yeah, there's a show, The Missing, where the missing a girl got missing, and the detective behind it had previously been on in different guises, and again, it was basically trying to locate the missing child, and it was trying to again piece together information, you know, leaving cliffhangers at the end of the episode, whatever, and just always engaging you with like what's he going to do next and what comes out of the woodwork, and you know what suddenly stops him from investigating this or what. What does he uncover? And then it's always, you know, where's the twist and what, you know, what's, how's he going to flip? That sort of thing. So yeah, you're right to do really, really well.
Okay, so let's crack on then with our films. Would you like to introduce your film for us and give us brief synopsis, please?
So what can I say? I picked 7.
Do you like what you do for a living? These things you see.
You have to wear blinders sometimes. Most times.
Detective William Somerset is looking for a way out.
You're retiring. 6 more days and you're all the way gone.
So how long have you lived here?
Too long.
Detective David Mills is looking for a way in.
We'll be spending every waking hour together from now until the time I leave. I'll show you who your friends and enemies are.
Look, I'm going to come inside 5 years, not here.
Now,
ladies and gentlemen, we have ourselves a homicide.
They're caught in a game.
No fingerprints and no witnesses of any kind.
Nope. About the only thing we know about that guy right now is he's totally insane.
Where the price of sin is death.
There are 7 deadly sins. Gluttony.
You're going to come take a look at this.
Greed.
No one touches anything.
Sloth. Wrath. Pride. Lust.
As a cop procedural is my pick. I don't know where to start with 7, because if you haven't seen it, first of all, go and watch it. It's basically a serial killer movie, right? A serial killer begins to start murdering people according to the 7 deadly sins. And then 2 detectives, Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, are assigned to the case. One's new to the city, Brad Pitt. One's been there, seen it, done it all, kind of looking about maybe retiring. Morgan Freeman. And they are trying to work out a criminal case. Now, on the face of it, it's almost a lazy premise. Serial killer, 7 deadly sins, it could go anywhere, right? And then you've seen it before. One cop's on call for the shit, live weapon, and one new guy, keen stuff. But the beauty of 7 is that it's just such a dark, horrible, miserable film. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in the best way possible. you know? And that's, so when you look at a sort of procedural film, but also a cop film, it takes everything you know about a cop film and just completely switches it. Because it's more about the 2 detectives. It's so much more about the crimes, how they're committed, why they're committed, and a reflection of society. So that's my sort of, you know, pitch for 7 and why you should, if you haven't seen it, definitely watch it.
Yeah, it is so bleak in like the best way possible. I mean, even the opening credits, it starts off on these credits. It has a mix of Closer, I think, by 9 Inch Nails, and it's all footage of the serial killer basically preparing his manifesto and his, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's just, I mean, it's influenced a lot of things like Saw, their credits. But yeah, it's just from the get-go, you're like, this is unnerving. I think I was reading things like people saw the credits and were like, nope, absolutely, this is not for me. So it sets the tone from the very beginning, and it opens up and we're in this city. It's an unknown city. and it is constantly raining. Exactly. And there is constantly sirens, constantly arguments, screaming, children crying. And it's just, even the setting, like, it's just so grim.
I know, right?
So grim.
That's the beauty of the film also, sorry to jump in there, is the fact that it doesn't let up on all that sort of stuff, right? It's almost like, I read something about it, it's almost like you're actually in hell.
Yeah.
Right? The film is depicted of hell. You know, people are doing whatever they're doing and there's crimes committed everywhere. And Morgan Freeman's just almost given up on society. Mm. He's like, what's the point? You know, I can't help society here. And you're almost, and then the character that the killer ends up being like a manifestation of Satan in the same way. And you're almost like thinking, what's going on here?
Mm.
And then what I love about the film is it doesn't change. It doesn't get any better.
Mm-hmm.
It just carries up until the ending, which we'll discuss in detail. Up until even beyond the ending, it doesn't get any better. It's just a bleak, bleak film, but in such a wonderful way.
Yeah, it's a film about apathy, isn't it? That's one of the main themes. The city, its residents, like you said, Morgan Freeman's character, Somerset, he tells Brad Pitt that people shouldn't yell rape if they're getting raped. They should yell fire because nobody cares about rape, but they care about fire. You know, there's a point at the beginning where he asks a fellow detective, like, did the child witness the murder? And the detective's like, I don't care. And it's just this apathy everywhere, as well as like sin, which is another big thing in this film, obviously. It's just everywhere. There's a point where he tells Tracy, Brad Pitt's wife, he's like, get out of the city, get out. Like, she confesses that she's pregnant to him, and he's like, for the sake of you and your child, get out. It's just,
and the best part on this, Brad Pitt is the optimist in the film. You know, so you sit there and Brad Pitt's all like, well, you know, new beginning, new city, my wife, you know, all sort of stuff. And he's like, well, I can make a difference. And Morgan Freeman's character's almost like, I was like you one day.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and that's, and like you said, the whole thing about, you know, women are taught to have to yell fire instead of rape, that instead of help and stuff, so you almost say yourself, because he's so conditioned to the way the city is. You know, there's this whole thing about the, you know, there's a whole thing about mental illness in the city as well, and people committing so many horrific crimes, and the city just decaying, the buildings are just dark and grey. There's everything you look at it, there's always something about the fact that you're on Morgan Freeman's side. You're like, why are you doing this? Why are you putting yourself through this? Why are you even bothering taking another case? Just walk. Because and it's really from the get-go, as you say, it takes you in. Because I saw this film, and I was one of the ones that had no idea going into it, saw it at the cinema when it came out for release. I'm like, okay, let's check it out. And the promotion behind it wasn't very, you know, enlightening at all. It was very much a case of, here's a film, blah, blah, two detectives. Mm-hmm. Okay, detective film. And you go in unaware of what you're going to experience. And you sit down, and obviously, again, no spoilers, but the killer's character isn't mentioned at all in credits, anything. You've got no idea. And I think Kevin Spacey insisted on that as well, right?
Yeah.
And then you're sitting there and you're just like watching this film and you don't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw it for the first time at the cinema, I had no idea what was going on. And it worked, because you don't expect this sort of film to hit you in that way, because you think it was a cop film.
Yeah.
They get the bad guy in the end, and that sort of thing. So the way it's, even from the way it's launched to, and I'd love to watch it again for the first time. Do you know what I mean? That's what
same,
just to experience all that again.
Yeah, and it's so funny because obviously when it came out, Brad Pitt was this Hollywood heartthrob that was known for being heartthrob in these kind of films where he hadn't really gotten to explore a darker side. And then he comes on and does this, and like you said, people went to it. It was like, woo, Brad Pitt film.
Yeah. They
went and were like, oh, holy shit, what the fuck have I walked into? And I love that. Like, he just subverted, you know, expectations of himself. I think that's great. But like you said, there is this duality with Somerset, who is Morgan Freeman's character, and Mills, Brad Pitt's character. They're the opposite of each other. You know, Somerset is the brains, Brad Pitt is the brawn. Somerset is very meticulous, Brad Pitt is very messy and kind of, you know, acts first, thinks later. But there's also a duality in Somerset and Doe, John Doe's character, which is Kevin Spacey, the serial killer. They live in very similar situations. They're both obsessed with their work. But whereas Somerset is very apathetic to sin, John Doe has taken it upon himself to avenge sin and to punish people. And he really hates people. And he has a passion for his work in a twisted way. So what did you think about John Doe's character? And we can do spoilers because this is a spoiler show. So what did you think about John Doe and his work, I guess?
There was a couple of things. Two things that jumped out to me when I sort of rewatched it recently again, obviously, in first time around. So I've seen it lots of times before. Two things that jump out for me is the character of John Doe embodies evil, right? It's really much about that. I'm now taking this upon myself to show you evil and show you what's going on in the world. But also, he's so meticulous. He's so... There's a scene where Morgan Freeman sees all the books and he's almost in awe of the literature and the education and, you know, the intellect that he possesses. And I think that's how I look at his character. He's so calculating. He's one step ahead at every point, you know, and he's always thinking. And his character is almost beyond, almost untouchable because he's so good at what he does. And the killing, I think, was it Sloth, where he's been tied to the bed for a year? That's planned for a year. And that's not a random serial killer. That's someone thought this out. You know, he's taken, got rid of any distinguishing marks, no fingerprints or nothing. And there's nothing there for him to be recognised by. And that's been planned. So as a character, I think he's a brilliant character in terms of the way it's written and what he embodies. But also he's got this intellect, almost like Hannibal Lecter, where he's almost like, well, I'm above you. You know, if you think you can get to me, try. If you think you can solve it for me, try. And I think there's a lot of that around him where I look at it and think of fascinating character. And, you know, he's smug and he's like nonchalant about his stuff. And he's like, he's again, supremely confident. And he thinks to himself, wow. And he's composed all the time. He's never flustered. So as a character, I think he's brilliant, as John Doe character. And I think he goes against exactly what Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman are as characters. They're the cops that just want to catch the bad guy, put him in jail and get it done. You know, and he's like, well, no, you're playing my game. You're going to do what I say. Up until the ending, they're still doing what he says. And the way it ends because of what he wants. And I think that's a brilliant, brilliant, clever character.
So let's think about talk about the actual setups for his sins. So like you said, he goes for the seven deadly sins. We have gluttony, greed, sloth, pride, lust, and then at the end we've got envy and wrath, which we'll talk about separately because that's a really interesting those setups are horrific. Like, we are introduced first. We are one of the first ones. Gluttony. Oh my god, gluttony. And the guy has been fed to death. He has eaten himself basically. To death. Sloth, like you said, this guy has been tied to the bed. And that is the most horrific scene, apart from the sex club scene. That's I keep saying that's the most horrific scene. And then I think of another scene. I'm like, no, that's the most horrific scene. But the sloth one. Is just because it has one of the greatest jump scares in it.
But the realization behind that scene is he planned this for a year. That's what gets you. The visuals there anyway. And then again, you almost sympathize because he's a drug dealer pedophile. Right? So as a character, from what I understand, from what I remember. And you're almost like, oh, he probably deserved it in a weird sort of twisted way. Because you're like, well, that's what these people should get. But the way he did it, and the way they managed to find the clues to where it was, and you know, then it uncovered his body, and then he just like, whoa, and that scare. You're right; it hits you right.
Yeah, and then the sex club scene is where they enact lust, and that is horrific. Like,
I know, right?
It's not as visual, we don't get a lot of visuals about it, but it's just the setup and the thought, because it is this contraption of like a knife in place of a dildo, and a John is forced to kill a sex worker with it. And it's just, oh my God. Like, oh, even thinking about it now, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm so disturbed.
When I first saw that scene, I was in the cinema watching it. First of all, I've seen it, I'm like, did they just say he did what he did?
Yeah.
Because again, in those, in well, 95, right? You didn't get, I mean, you got horror, don't get me wrong, but you didn't get something as almost, I wouldn't say real, but it was almost as blunt as that.
Yeah.
And the scene, you walk in and it's like, yeah, the guy was forced to rape this girl with the dildo in place of a knife. Yeah. Kind of thing. You're like, what the way? How?
Yeah.
And it blows your mind because they gave you that imagery without even showing it to you.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And you're like, what the hell? And the guy's there, you know, he's, you know, gun in his mouth, being forced, and like, and you're almost thinking, where do I go with this? How do I process this? How do you even understand that this actually happened, let alone someone managed to plot, think it out, and get it acted out? It's just, it's horrific. It really was.
Yeah. It's almost that thing of it's scarier what you don't see.
Yeah.
And it leaves it to your imagination, and that just, disturbing as hell. So wrath and envy are the last two sins. And before we get to
I'm jumping. The pride one was, I thought was pretty gruesome as well, where she's got painkillers.
That's right.
And then the phone in the other hand, like, what do you do? And you again, you're like, what do you do? You know, because she knows she's going to lose some part of her features or body, right? And she gets her nose and face and that cut off. And even that, it's like, where do you go with this? Because you've always recovered from this one, these other previous sins and kills. And then suddenly, this is woman here, and he's like, make a choice.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah, it is very much like, you can definitely see where Saw came from.
Yeah.
Out of these, you know, it was pretty much leaving it in the hands of the person, kind of.
Yeah.
Especially with that one.
Yeah.
But wrath and envy are the last two sins, and before they are presented in the way that they are, John Doe gives himself up to the police. He basically walks into the police station. He's like, "Here I am, arrest me." And you think that was easy. And it's funny because like they don't really question it all that much. I think Somerset's a little bit suspicious, but they don't. Yep. They're like, "Right, we've got him now. But where are the two final bodies?" And he's like, "Well, I'll show you." And so they get in the car and they drive out to where he's taking them. There's a helicopter flying in the air, and he gets the guy to deliver a parcel. And it turns out Somerset goes out while Mills has his gun on John Doe, and he opens the box, and there is the, we don't see it, but there is the box where we know that Mills' wife's head is in it. And because she was also pregnant, so she was killed with the unborn baby. And so that scene transpires, that Brad Pitt's character Mills is the character of Wrath. And because John Doe says he envies Brad Pitt, Mills's life, he is the character of Envy. So what did you think of that final scene?
Where do I start with that? So for me, the ending, first of all, you don't know what you're going to get with the ending, right? Mm-hmm. So you're sitting there, you're in the journey, you're in the car with Kevin, basically John Doe's character, and you're like, okay, he's going to dig up two. In my mind, I'm thinking there's probably two bodies sitting in the desert somewhere, gruesomely killed. Maybe I thought maybe they, you know, chopped to pieces in a ditch somewhere. I don't know, right? And you get there, and obviously it's not. There's a box, but the line, "What's in the box?"
Yeah. What's in the box? Hooked,
right? Yeah, I know. And we all want to know. And at that moment, when the film was being played, I want to finish this now. I want the redemption. I want to arrest you. I want to catch you. I want to put you in jail. Done. And we're like, "What's in the box? What's in the box?" And the best part is, Brad Pitt doesn't know, right? And Morgan Freeman walks over, and Morgan Freeman looks in a box, and he knows what's going to happen. He knows what's happening. What's going to happen to Brad Pitt? He also knows how he's going to react.
Yeah.
And John Doe is standing there, and he's like, "This is exactly what I planned from the get go." This, and you look at it, and you almost think to yourself, and think, "What would I do?"
Yeah.
And you act like Roth. You want to kill him.
Yeah.
Exactly what you want. And there's never a different approach to that film. It's never going to end a different way. It's always going to be, you killed my wife, you're going down. Mm-hmm. And the ending, for me, there's a couple of things that also really it stuck out was when we're sitting there and the camera pans out, you get this vision of solitude where Kevin Spacey, Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt are just sat there and you can see Brad Pitt just pacing up and down. Mm-hmm. And you get anxious watching him, thinking, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? But all you see is them three. Mm-hmm. And amongst all the stuff you see at the start of the film, all the chaos, all the blood, it eventually boils down to just three of them at the end,
mm-hmm.
having to basically complete the film for us.
Mm.
And I think that was fascinating, the way that was shot. And for me, once he does what he does, he shoots him, and we don't get a resolution.
No.
Because ultimately, it's not a triumph. He's not won. Yes, John Doe's dead, but that's what he wanted. So in actual fact, we've given him what he wanted. John Doe's the winner, right? And evil, in my view, evil wins. You've just got now to come to terms with it. Now Brad Pitt has to come to terms with the fact of what he's done, what he's lost, how he continues. And Morgan Freeman is there thinking, I better support this kid because he's going to go into pieces otherwise. You know, so the ending just, you know, there's a lot more to it. And I think, from what I remember, there's a couple of alternative endings as well where they don't shoot, or I think someone intervenes, and I think Morgan Freeman will intervene. But I remember Fincher, reading an article, Fincher really wanted this ending because it was so bleak and it was in keeping the rest of the film. They didn't want a resolution. And we don't get a resolution because evil continues. Hell is still there. They haven't won. They have not stopped this, and it will carry on. So, sorry, I've gone on way tangent now, but that really, for me, is one of the best endings to that sort of film because you don't get what you want.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because really, John Doe embodies Wrath. He is the one that, you know, is sick of these people and these perceived sins and carrying out these murders, horrific, horrific murders. He is Wrath embodied, but it is his initial meeting with Detective Mills, where he is standing in as a photographer coming up to the crime scene, and Detective Mills has a go at him and like shouts at him and threatens him. It is that display of wrath from Mills where John Doe goes, he's my wrath. He's who I need to transfer this to. And I need to be envy. And it's really interesting that that split second scene was what caused John Doe to then go and basically set his target on Detective Mills.
Exactly. And the funny thing behind that was that when you look at, how he was, John Doe, he was envious of Mills, not because of, because of the life that he wanted, but also envious of that because he felt that Mills, he was envious of the way he could lead this life, where he felt burdened, John Doe felt burdened as the epitome of evil, as a benefit of Satan. And he's like, I want to release this. I want what John Doe, Mills has. And I can't have it because of who I am. And I think it worked really well because you look at it and think, well, what's he envious of? You know? And yes, he didn't like the sins that people were committing in the movie, but he was, because he was so patient and because he was so methodical in his approach, he was envious of having not having that regular life. So he was methodical in the fact, like, okay, I'll do what I've got to do. I'll complete my mission, as it were. But I myself don't get resolution. I don't get any satisfaction from doing these murders. I don't get any joy. Nothing's completed for me. He's still envious. And I think they capture that really, really well because, again, bizarrely, you're like, I get why he did it. You don't sympathise with John Doe, but you understand him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So would you recommend Seven to horror fans?
100%. 100%. You have to watch it. If you haven't watched it, watch it. If you haven't watched it in a while, rewatch it because there's so much to pick up. It's a brilliant, brilliant film.
Absolutely. There's a reason why it's on, you know, the greatest films of all time. It's fantastic. Like, I love those films that you can watch and rewatch and watch, and every time you notice something a little bit different. Like this time I watched it and I noticed the colours. We were saying, you know, wrath and envy are the most important sins in this film. And everything's either red or green, which of course are the representatives of those particular scenes. So like every time I watch it, there's something different, and I love those films. I love those kind of films.
And if, and there's almost like a when you look at the start, the credits and the start of the film, there's almost like this. I don't know how to put it. I keep thinking of the word jazz. I don't know why, but you know when you think of like smoky jazz rooms, and there's stuff going on somewhere there, and something going, you get that vibe of the city, and you know the old sort of cop homage where you know smoke comes from the drain and just something, that sort of stuff, and you get like this that vibe of like a busy jazz room or a busy you know musical room where so much is going on. That aesthetic plays right throughout the film. And even like, again, I've referenced it before, Silence of the Lambs has got similar tones where, you know, everything is a bit darker. Everything is a bit, you know, just you're almost straining your eyes to see that and blinking and miss it kind of stuff. And I think that aesthetic plays well throughout the whole film because it is the rain, you know, smokiness, the almost like the turgidness of the whole film is captured in a screen. And you look at it and you're almost like, you're almost wiping yourself down after watching that film, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that point leads us nicely then onto my choice of film, which was Silence of the Lambs.
You spook easily, Starling?
Not yet, sir.
He's past the others. The last cell. I'll be watching. You'll do fine.
A killer is on the loose.
Keeps them alive for 3 days. Then he shoots them, skins them, and dumps them.
A rookie FBI agent is on his trail.
He's got real physical strength, cautious, precise, and he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
But in order to track him down, she'll have to match wits.
I'll help you catch him, Clary.
Believe me, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head.
With the darkest of all minds.
Just do your job, but never forget what he is.
But he's a monster. Pure psychopath. So rare to capture one alive.
So close to the way you're gonna catch him, do you realize that?
Oh, Clarice, your problem is you need to get more fun out of life.
You told me you don't spook easily.
You call this easy, sir?
Lecter's missing an arm.
Man, it's a raving maniac. Who knows what he'll do?
They kind of make a really good, they do make a good double watch if you're up for that, because I can understand it being quite hard going. So Silence of the Lambs is a 1991 psychological horror film directed by Jonathan Demme, I don't know, adapted from Thomas Harris's novel. It stars Jodie Foster as Clarice Starling, who is a trainee FBI agent, who gets asked by the behavioral analysis unit, Jack Crawford, to go and interview a Dr. Hannibal Lecter to gain some insight into a current serial killer that is operating called Buffalo Bill, who has been kidnapping young women and then skinning them and dumping them.
Basically.
Yes, lovely, lovely. It is a classic, isn't it?
I mean, it's one of them films where you, if you haven't seen it, you have to, and you have to probably watch it again just to get so much of what's missed in the first viewing.
Yeah, are you a fan of it?
I am. So I wasn't initially when I first watched the film. I was like, they missed a trick, and what I mean by that is because I was like, I didn't appreciate the dialogue in the film. I wanted a bit more of like action. I want a bit more of like, let's see things happening. But on a second watch, it just came across completely different. It was such a powerful film. The way the exchanges between Hannibal Lecter and Jodie Foster's character, I forget her name now. I should know her name, mostly.
Clarice Starling.
Clarice Starling. That's a minute ago. That's right. They were so engrossing, and that makes the film. But I didn't appreciate that first time around. But yeah, now I'm like, it's an amazing, amazing film.
Yeah, it's such. I would have had actually the same reaction as you, that I didn't appreciate it the first time round, and it was, you know, it's a bit talky and. But I guess as my interests in stuff like behavioral analysis of criminals and serial killers has kind of gained. This film is fascinating, especially because we have two killers and they're both very different from each other, but somehow Hannibal Lecter has become the cult icon. Why do you think that is? Why do you think he gained the notoriety? Do you think it was Anthony Hopkins' performance?
Yes. I think the way he played it was phenomenal. And again, it goes back to what I said earlier about that character had so much poise and grandeur and intellect and intelligence that you're almost in awe of that character. Mm-hmm. And again, it was like, Jodie Foster's talking to him and he's like, I'm above you.
Yeah.
And when that comes across, that character is such a powerful character. You're almost like, okay, I can see why, you know, you are as good as what you, you know, as good as you are with the words that you say, because he's playing with Jodie all the time. He's always continually playing a game. So it's like chess. And he's like, you say this, I'll come back with this. You say this. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, you can't beat me here. You can't defeat me. And his performance is fantastic, but the character itself, he's just in the confines of a room. That's all he is.
Mm.
He's got not much else to play with. And what he does, Anthony Hopkins, in that character, and in that room, sorry, it's just phenomenal the way, first time around, I didn't respect it as much or appreciate it much. Mm. Second time around, the power of the dialogue, the power of what he says, his delivery, just takes it to another level.
Yeah, and I think that that Jonathan Demme does as well, when Lecter is delivering his lines, he's staring straight at the camera. It is a straight on profile, and it's like he's saying it to us, the audience. And Anthony Hopkins just has this maniacal stare that is very subtle and very quiet, but it's these big blue eyes that just stare straight down at the camera and says these lines with like this very soft, it's not like I'm intentionally trying to be overbearing and scary. It's very softly spoken.
Yeah.
But just, he's so creepy. And some of the things he says to Clarice is so inappropriate. And especially because you know he was a psychiatrist and that is what he worked as.
Exactly. But
he was like a cannibal. And
And the best thing about that is when he's looking at you, and when you're in those scenes and you're sitting there because you're just focused on scenes, so much terror and so much horror gets portrayed in that, because again, you don't see it, but it's being talked about. And in your brain, you're picturing it. It's like reading a book, right? You're not showing it. You're not showing anything. You're just reading it and interpreting it how you want to. So that's what we're doing there. And then again, he continually tries to just sort of keep painting that picture in your head. But the horror isn't what you, again, it's not what you see, it's what you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
And what's described and the way it's delivered. And, it's, and his face, there's something about, like I said, it's maniacal, but it's calculated at the same time. Mm. And it's perfect the way he delivers what he does.
Yeah. And I also find him quite cheeky. Like there's one of the last, he escapes. And at the end, I know we're skipping ahead, but at the end of the film, he calls Clarice at her graduation. And he's like, I've got to go. I'm having an old friend for dinner. And he sees his ex, like a prison guard, kind of coming off a plane. And it's just so funny. But, you know, like that means he's going to go eat him. But you're you cheeky thing, Dr. Lecter. I know, right? So let's talk about the other killer then, Buffalo Bill. What do you make of his character?
Again, you know, it's when you watch it when it came out to when you watch it now, very different.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the skinning, that sort of stuff is there. But what I recently picked up on was the cross-dressing side of it all, and that trope of, I don't know if I'm opening the can of worms, I'm not sure if you can discuss, but a lot of transphobia is happening as well there in that film because of the fact that, he's implied to be somebody lesser than he is because he's cross-dressing, because he, you know, when he sort of dresses like the way he does. And they're blaming that on maybe mental illness, and they're blaming it on maybe he wants to be something. And then he's killing because of maybe that's what's inside him. He's got to almost, if you look at it, you think, well, because he feels that way, that's why he's doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
But there's one element that I pick up, but another element of Buffalo Bill is that he's brutal.
Yeah,
because he's just so blunt with what he's doing. He's like, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to do it. You're not going to stop me. And it's almost two sides of the same coin, where you've got this one character who is cross-dressing, who is acting that way, which you wouldn't associate necessarily with someone who's so brutal, so much of a, you know, a deadly killer. But they do it really well. And I think now, if you watch it now, you completely see that in a different way to when you would saw it in 1991.
Yeah, it's a very interesting but touchy discourse on this film. Because, I mean, obviously, as a cis person, I can't really say this is offensive or it's not offensive. I can only listen to trans people about what they say about this film. But there's a really interesting conversation that Clarice has with Lecter, and is like, well, is he trans or are they trans? Is that why they are doing this? And Lecter goes, no, he's not trans, because he went to doctors and doctors said he wasn't. But and it's just, it's a really like, well, if someone says I'm a trans person, then you believe them. Like, whether, I mean, you know, doctors aren't really well versed in a lot of the time in gender studies, or, you know, the feeling of gender dysphoria or anything like that. And so it's really weird, because on one way they're saying, you know, I think he says something like trans people are trans, they don't have a choice, which is quite progressive. But then on the other hand, he's saying, oh, just because he said that they say they're trans doesn't mean they're trans. And you're like, well, actually, like, so it's really strange. And obviously I can't have, you know, the voice of it because I'm a cis person. But I mean, I can definitely see the controversy that surround it, especially when horror has a history of, you know, the monstrous queer, and especially with what is going on at the moment when it comes to the rights of trans people. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting discussion.
Go ahead. I'll say, just to add to that, when you look at it from Clarice's character, she's so blatantly a woman, and they emphasize the fact on numerous occasions, and it's played upon and it's showed upon the height, and it's very, very clear. With Buffalo Bill's sexuality or gender isn't discussed or isn't clarified at all.
On that point, like, that was one thing I really noticed. This was like, Starling is constantly surrounded by men who are a lot taller than her, and it's really uncomfortable, and it's really objective. Like, even Jack Crawford objectifies her, and, you know, she goes to two insect experts and they objectify her, and it's just like, you know, she gets into the lift at one point when she's going down to talk to Jack Crawford, and there's a bunch of guys and they're all like a good foot or two taller than her, and they're all in red shirts, and it just screams danger. And it's just so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable that her gender is really, like you said, amplified and highlighted. And, you know, I guess especially in the FBI, perhaps back in the day, I don't know what it's like now, but perhaps back in the day, it was like, oh, this is a man's milk. What's a woman doing here, kind of thing.
Exactly right.
It's definitely an uncomfortable point in this film.
It really is. And I think the other thing with that is, like, you know, because you're never sure, and because you're never, it's never clarified, it's almost a case of, you know, has Buffalo Bill's character done this because he wished he was a woman, and does he hate himself? And again, that trope is, in them days, probably would have flown and said, you know what, yeah, okay, because in the 90s was a lot different than we are now. And then you look at that and think yourself, okay, he maybe he wanted to be a woman, and maybe he wished he could do this, so therefore it's like, you know, he's doing what he can because he hates himself, not because he hates the people he's killing. And then you stick it back on him and start questioning about, well, again, do you sympathize with this guy because he's having issues, because he's not clear within himself? And I think it does it really well, because it doesn't really, it leaves it up to us to understand that and appreciate and understand, and make sense of that. At the same time, reminding you he's a brutal serial killer that skins people, and like you said, he makes a new suit out of skin, that sort of thing. So they do, again, they juxtapose that really, really well.
I do worry though, especially with the discussions that are going on at the moment about trans rights, is that, you know, they say trans people are a danger to women, and I do worry that this depiction further pushes that harmful stereotype. So there is that when you're looking back at a lens from this day and age that you're kind of like, that can be a bit dodgy. So the inclusion of the butterflies and the moths is a really interesting one. Of course, it's on, you know, the front cover, the poster, a death head moth. What did you think about the symbology behind the butterflies and the moths?
Again, when I first watched it, it went over my head.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really appreciate it for what it was, right? Mm-hmm. But it's, again, it symbolizes death or rebirth. Mm-hmm. And those sort of things. So again, on a rewatch, I'm like, oh, okay, I get it now. And I think without, you know, I don't want to prolong this answer too much, but for me, that was all it was. Mm. And for me, I understood that to be, okay, that's the meaning of why the moth is there. It's almost something along the lines of, you know, the ways, I think in the image, that it's similarly designed that looks like a human head. I think I read somewhere about it, or it looks kind of the way it is. And a lot of the imagery around the butterfly or the moth at this place has so much death around it. It, for me, it becomes that. And at the same time, there's with a moth, it's almost about having that reminder that it's always there. But again, I want to know your view, because I think it's obviously your pick. I want to explore more on that for me, because I think I've still personally got a lot more to learn about that symbolism of the film.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we see it with Buffalo Bill's character, how, you know, they want to transform and they want to, you know, be reborn as someone else. But I also see it in Clarice Starling's character. Like we said, during the majority of the film, she is surrounded by men who are a lot taller than her and talk down at her, or, you know, try to kill her, or, you know, are just generally very creepy to her. And then after her confrontation with Buffalo Bill, and she's gone through that and she's killed him, it's almost like she's reborn. She's a lot more confident. Yeah. She knows that she's very capable. And there's a point where Jack Crawford comes to talk to her during her graduation, and she is no longer looked down upon by, like, literally by these men. She's, an equal standing, and he shakes her hand. He's not looking down at her. He's not, like, doing anything else creepy towards her. He shakes her hand, and it's like this transformation into, you know, it shouldn't have been this way. She should have been respected all along. But it is like this transformation that now she's proved herself to her peers. Yeah. She's on equal standing with them.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what you get for the film when you watch it again. That metamorphosis of her character.
Yeah,
you know, when she comes in for the first time, when she walks through the corridor, she you know, by the end of the film, she's like, I'm in control here.
Yeah,
I'm gonna get what I need to, you know. So yeah, 100% agree on that. And I think that's probably why, again, first watch, you're gonna miss it.
Yeah,
because you're focused on what isn't there, I suppose. So going back to it now, second, third, fourth watch, I've seen it, you continually start sort of, and then you start picking up on character development, and you start looking at her character, even the way she talks to Hannibal Lecter, even the way her interrogation technique, or even her, that battle of wits, you can see her change is developing throughout the film, to the point where, again, like I said, she's in control here, and she wants to get what she wants to get. And I think Jodie Foster does that really, really well, because it's difficult to continually, I suppose, have or play a character that is, like we said, so looked down upon, convey that sense of inferiority, then throughout the film show that growth and show that, you know, show that change, which is obviously the symbolism that we're talking about, but also the character develops the same way, and you're on board with it because, like, well, okay, let's see what we go with this.
Do you think, and I think this is really interesting, perhaps I'm completely wrong, but whereas with a lot of horror classics, you can see their influence in later works, whereas I don't really see an influence. I feel like, whether this is a good thing or not, I feel that, like, Silence of the Lambs is very standalone, and perhaps, I mean, obviously other people have tried to emulate it. But I don't see, you know, if we look at something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or The Exorcist, we can see a very clear influence in modern works of horror or later works of horror. Whereas I don't see that with Silence of the Lambs. Do you think I'm wrong?
Say that again. I'm thinking about answer, but say that again.
Do you think it has influenced later works of horror?
Right. I'm probably on par with you to say probably not in so much as the way the film plays out.
Mm-hmm.
But where you have films, and again, going back to Seven, for example,
yeah,
that the battle of wits
mm-hmm.
between characters, and that again the growth of a character where a rookie cop mm-hmm. is trying to do something, and I've not got examples of films right now, and then that rookie cop eventually through the end of the film finds their feet, and mm-hmm. so there's probably some influence there to some degree, because you can mm-hmm. call back, and again playing the character that Anthony Hopkins does.
Mm-hmm.
There's a demeanor about him that you'd want to replicate, and I think you can see that in films going, and again John Doe in Seven is a good example of that, where
mm-hmm.
Fincher probably looked at it and thought, I like the way he conveyed that line, or I like the fact that, you know, the literary aspect or the intellectual aspect came across as a very, very powerful way of conveying that character. So I think there's influences, but again at the same time, as a film it stands alone, because no one's sort of done that in the way that we see it again. And I say that because now the whole trend about serial killer podcasts or serial killer documentaries and stuff has mm-hmm. been more about the evidence gathering, more about the result of that serial killer mm-hmm. committing their crimes, and less about the interaction between the serial killer and how the cop brought them down, or how mm-hmm. the cop understood their motives and got for what better expression in their skin, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where that Silence of the Lambs really, really stands alone, because I don't think we've had, I can't think of examples now, but I don't think we've had a film that conveys that in the same way it does.
Yeah. So would you recommend Silence of the Lambs to horror fans?
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. But, and there's a but on this, it would play differently now. It will pay differently now. I think I'd love to see some recent reviews or reviews of first-time watchers in the last few years to see how they play it, because you've got to take it for what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wouldn't say it's of its time, you know, mm-hmm. but there are things in there that play better in the 90s than it would now.
Yeah.
But as a horror film, and again, the horror is what you don't see
mm-hmm.
And what's implied. It's definitely a horror film, but B, a film for horror fans, because mm-hmm. again, it lets your mind fill in the blanks, which is the best thing about that film.
Yeah, I would just be like, you know, this is Hannibal Lecter, and you know, this is where he comes from, and he is one of the greatest film villains there is. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would. So out of the two films, if you had to pick one of them, which one would you pick?
I'd pick Seven, only because I've seen it so many more times, and I love how that film just doesn't let up. There's no remorse in that film. It's a bleak, bleak, dark film, and it continues. And the best part of me, like I said, the best part for me, why I pick it, is because there is no resolution. It's such a great metaphor for what the film's conveying. Hell is everywhere.
Yeah,
you're not going to win. Right. And I picked that over Silence of the Lambs, but it's a close call, definitely.
Yeah. I would be the same. I'd pick Seven. I think I could go without seeing Silence of the Lambs again ever. Yeah. Whereas I want to rewatch Seven quite regularly.
Yeah.
Seven's just my cup of tea. It's Silence of the Lambs is dark, but aesthetically, Seven's dark. And
it's a great big screen film. Yeah. Seven. People may not have seen it on big screen because you know, again, especially nowadays. But I've seen both on the big screen, and
mm-hmm.
Seven just plays differently on the big screen because again, you're absorbed by the set, by the location, by everything you're seeing. You're almost like in the film, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd go with seven. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting cop procedurals with me. Now, I know last time I did ask you what your favorite horror film. So this time, before we go, I'm going to ask, do you have any recommendations for us on horror films that you think people should be seeing?
Oh, new or old, or just in general?
General.
I mean, where do I start?
All right, we'll do new ones then, just to make it a little bit easier.
Renfield. Watch Renfield. I really enjoyed Renfield. Really, really good. Evil Dead Rise, obviously, I think worked well. There are some reviews which say, yeah, it wasn't great, but I think it was a great Evil Dead movie for what it did. And I think it played really well. And you're never going to replicate what the first one did, but I think it does really, really well, to be fair. Horror is a funny one. So there's a film on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen it called Speak No Evil.
Yes, I have seen that, yes.
Yeah. I don't recommend watching it because of the way it ends, but I do recommend people watch the film at some point because of the way it ends. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, I understand completely what you mean. Yes, bleak. Absolutely. Very it's like when people ask me for like extreme film recommendations, and I'm like, maybe Megan is missing, but don't watch it. But do watch it. But maybe don't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And two other things that spring to mind recently. Infinity Pool. If you haven't seen, that's definitely one to watch. It's so surreal, but it's so brilliant in the way. It shows what it does. It's trippy as hell, but it's such a good film.
Mm-hmm.
And one last film, actually, which, again, it's, I don't know if you've seen it. It's very bleak, very, very blunt. It's called Holy Spider.
No, I want to see it, though. I've seen some really good things about it, so it's definitely going on my watch list.
Again, serial killer theme, and it rounds off the podcast really nicely, by the way. Mm-hmm. Serial killer theme. But so brutal and so... Mm-hmm. Again, it's similar... themes, you know, someone thinks it in God's work and there's some around it, but again, just, you know, trigger warning, there's a lot in there that is blunt, brutal and horrific, and again, some that you don't see, again, don't thank me for watching it, because it's not a good film to watch or enjoy, but it's brilliant in what it does. That really, I walked away feeling a bit numb having watched that, to be fair.
Yeah. Sounds like my cup of tea. okay, so where can people find you on social media?
Yep, so everywhere across social media, I'm just Mal Jutley, so Maljutley. I mostly post on Twitter and Instagram, really. And again, on my Twitter bio, there's a link to a mental health blog that I occasionally write. It's making time to write, and I'm a massive mental health advocate. So there's stuff on there as well if you want to read into that.
So that was my chat there with Mal about cop procedurals, and we discussed 1991's The Silence of the Lambs and 1995's Seven. So let me know what you think. Do you think psychological thrillers and cop procedurals belong in the horror genre? And what do you think of these two films? Let me know on Twitter @what_scream, and I'm also on Blue Sky now as What a Scream, and Instagram @what_a_scream, and don't forget to like, review, subscribe on whatever platform you are listening to me on, and don't forget to stay horrific. Goodbye.